that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey, the journey towards deconstructing hell.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This podcast miniseries has been created as a companion to the book by the same title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, edited by myself, Chad Ball, and published by Sacrosage Press. This show is brought to you in partnership with the Rethinking Faith podcast and is hosted by the guest we have today, Josh Patterson. So Josh is the author of chapter 13 of the Deconstructing Hell book, titled A Young Pastor's Journey in Deconstruction. So as you can tell already, Josh is not hosting this episode. I am hosting this episode, and I will be interviewing Josh because I want to really dive into his chapter specifically. I think it was a great chapter, has a lot of important stuff to say. So I'm excited to get into it. So hi, Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going well, my friend. How is it to be sitting on the opposite side of the microphone, if you will?
Yeah, it's fun. I always like, I don't know, maybe selfishly like being interviewed because it feels like less work. And and then I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. I like it. It's fun and it I don't know. It gets me thinking differently. And so yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah, for sure, man. For sure. Well, I was excited to have you as part of this book. And, you know, I learned about you through listening to your podcasts and, you know, kind of stepped out and asked you to be a part of the project that I was working on here. So I'm glad to have read your chapter and glad to have the opportunity now to dive a little bit deeper into the background of it. So looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited. We'll see what past Josh said. And if present Josh is likes past Josh
is in agreement. No. I like it. I like it. You never step into the same stream twice. I heard someone say once. So
yeah, wink, wink. Go. I like it.
All right. So you know, we've gotten to know so many authors personally over the course of the Deconstructing Hell podcast series that you've so graciously hosted. Many of our listeners already know you. From your podcast, Rethinking Faith. But for those that don't, how about just tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you go from average Joe on the streets to a podcaster extraordinaire?
Well, I don't know if extraordinaire is a good word, but podcast extraordinaire adjacent. We'll go with that. my name is Josh Patterson. I used to be a pastor. I served in vocational ministry for just under 6 years at a parachurch organization and then in three different churches. My story with that is long, But the short version is I had some very negative experiences working within the church that led to a mental health crisis and ultimately to what today people are calling deconstruction. And currently am working as a brewer. I make beer now.
Awesome.
Yeah. And that's been an interesting process. Doing that, I've been brewing now professionally for like just over 2 years, maybe closer to 2.5. So that's kind of, you know, vocationally or professionally what I find myself doing. But when it comes to podcasting, I've kind of, ever since college, have been a giant nerd and have this problem where Amazon doesn't stop sending books to my house. And I try to, I try to tell my wife, like, I don't get it. Like, they just show up. so I read a lot. I constantly am, I can't turn my brain off, constantly thinking, constantly, you know, wanting to read and discover new ideas. And so the podcast was kind of birthed out of that. I had a buddy named Andy, who was, you know, very opposite of me. Andy is training to be a Presbyterian pastor. He's like a Westminster confession or bust kind of guy. And we started the podcast to kind of show that people from various theological backgrounds can have meaningful conversations together. And that worked until it didn't. And ultimately, Andy left the podcast. And then, yeah, it became Rethinking Faith instead of what it used to be, Theology Doesn't Suck. And now it's just kind of, you know, I've gone through two other co-hosts. So maybe I'm like a shitty person to do a podcast with. but now I do it solo. And we just kind of
the most committed of the podcasters.
it could be that. yeah, and we just I don't know. I like having meaningful conversations that invite people into my own life journey and experience and into the, you know, journey experience of the people that I interview. You know, with the hopes that they might find themselves there as well. And let people know that they are seen and that they're loved and that they belong. No matter what they kind of think or believe right now. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, Theology Doesn't Suck was probably one of, if not the first really deconstruction podcast I ever listened to. I don't know that you would necessarily title it a deconstruction podcast, but as I was deconstructing some of my views and thoughts, you're one of the people that I kind of tuned into. And I always appreciated your gracious demeanor with your guests, your kind of generosity of spirit, I suppose. Just embracing kind of everybody where they are at, allowing them to kind of dive a little deeper into their own thinking and expound on it. And I think you bring in a lot of people in that past podcast and your current podcast that I think help a lot of us, you know what ideas are out there, know what people are thinking, and know the options, I guess, we have, you know, in such a way that it's in a safe environment, that we can kind of explore some things maybe we haven't explored in the past. So I appreciate your work, man. I really do.
Sweet. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So it's always cool to, I don't know. So I have a very low self-esteem and so like image. And so, I'm very, negative when it comes to like things that I do. And so it's always, encouraging to hear, you know, that's something that I put out there, like people find helpful or meaningful. That's always helpful because I don't often think that I'm working on it, you know, my therapist, whatever, but it's encouraging and it gives me kind of like motivation to keep, I don't know, to keep reading and having fun conversations with people. Cause it seems like, oh, cool. Well, it made a difference to somebody and that's good enough for me. So like it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, no problem. No problem. Well, I appreciate you sharing a little bit about kind of who Josh Patterson is and some of your background. And yeah, you get into your story pretty deeply in your chapter. In fact, the goal of me bringing you in was really so you can share your journey in that way. So, podcaster, but not necessarily a pervasive author. What made you say yes to this ask to be part of this book?
Yeah. So like writing has been something that I kind of aspire to. I like trying to put out ideas and information and these kind of things. But I always have a hard time actually sitting down and doing that. Yeah. I've tried many times. Yeah. And so kind of when you reached out and asked about this project specifically, I was like, oh, cool. This is kind of something, you know, hell and kind of questioning that was not really like the first thing that I started to kind of question when like my, you know, deconstruction started. But I remember it was something that I spent a whole lot of time on.
Yeah.
And, you know, having conversations with my friend, Jace Broadhurst. He's a pastor and like, you know, OT, Old Testament, like hermeneutics, PhD scholar kind of guy.
Yeah.
And so the subject matter is really what drew me into it, because I was like, oh, cool. This is something that like I wrestled with greatly. And even though I don't think about it as much today as I did maybe 3 years ago, I remember past versions of Josh and how difficult wrestling through this topic was and how engaged I was in it. And so I was like, I want to try to contribute something that can help people who also find themselves in past Josh's experience. And so that's really what motivated it. Why I agreed to do it is because I wanted to at least offer my experience and say, this is what was helpful to me. And maybe that'll be helpful to you, dear reader, or not, maybe yeah, not, but I wanted to put it out there just to, yeah. Cause I know what it's like to be in that space.
And really that was kind of my goal in constructing the book, right? Like I wanted to have kind of a systematic approach to the different chapters. Like I wanted to approach eternal conscious torment and deconstruct it from the standpoint of history, from the standpoint of philosophy. I wanted to offer some, you know, compelling alternatives. So Tom Ward generously did his chapter on relentless love. Keith Giles, you know, did universal restoration. I commissioned myself to do conditional immortality. And I think that's all well and important, but I think some of the most important chapters of the book were the end, in which I wanted to say, how does this boil down to real life? And how does this relate to personal experience? You can relate to things through information and you can learn facts, but I think people, you know, are most intrigued and engaged when a personal story is being shared. So I wanted to recruit you to do that, because I knew you do pretty good job. You did it well on on your podcast, so I knew you would do it good in writing, and you didn't disappoint. So definitely appreciate it. So one of the things that I thought was interesting and a great point, we call this book Deconstructing Hell, and you know, we talk about journeys of deconstruction. But one of your initial points that you make in your chapter was your take on the term deconstruction. So, you know, you kind of have a love-hate relationship with that word, right? So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I, So I'm trying to, this is where I need to be graceful in my language. I appreciate the word deconstruction and kind of how it is now being used today, right? I think deconstruction is like a very real phenomenon, an experience that people are going through. And I want to be very careful in my language because I want to respect that. And I'm not trying to write people's stories or experiences off, because I like, it's my story too. Mm-hmm. But where I think we can kind of get into trouble with the kind of deconstruction stuff is in kind of the framing of the conversation. And what I mean by that is a lot of the times when we're deconstructing, we are breaking down a perspective on the Christian faith. However, I think oftentimes we have been, if you're like me, so I'll speak in instead of generalities, I'll speak in my experience. I grew up in an evangelical perspective where I was told that evangelicalism is Christianity. That's sure. the whole thing. Yeah. And so when I deconstructed that, the temptation there is to think that I am deconstructing the entire faith. That now the entire Christian faith is obviously bogus because I destroyed evangelicalism. And I don't think that's entirely fair, right? The picture is much bigger than that. The church is a lot deeper. Christianity is a lot more broad. There's a lot more room for disagreement than that. But then also too, there's kind of a, I don't know, I have an aversion to the word because of how some people who use it become so, kind of the language I use, they become so inclusive that they become exclusive. Because deconstruction, people aren't actually learning how to think. They're just learning what to think. And so it's just, you're just crossing from here's the things that are good and these are the things that are bad. You flip to the other side and now it's like, no, the things that are bad are now good. The things that were good are now bad. Something like that. That's, again, generalization. But you're still, say you're leaving fundamentalism, you're still a fundamentalist. Right. Your thinking has not changed. It's still black and white, this or that, yes and no. And so then you just continue to perpetuate all the things that you say you don't like, just on the other side of things now. You know, you're still exclusive, you're still angry, you're still whatever. And then finally, one more thing, and then I'll shut up, is I think when we play this deconstruction game, we're constantly defining ourselves by a system that we say we no longer agree with. And so if we're constantly deconstructing evangelicalism, then we're defining ourselves as, I am not evangelical. I'm anti that thing, but you're still defining yourself by that thing that you claim to hate by its own rules and terms and conditions. And so I'm not interested in that. I had that stage. I threw the rocks. I was angry, and it's an important thing. Like, I don't want to discredit that. It needs to happen, but I don't want to get stuck there. Sure. If that makes sense. That was a lot. So I apologize, but that's kind of the
I think it's fine. And I agree. You know, I agree with you. I think ultimately, if we're using the term deconstruction as a defining word to characterize us, it is inaccurate, right? Like I think deconstruction could be a process. It you know, kind of connotes tearing something down. And maybe there's some things in our life that ways we view things or ways we approach things that, you know, should be undone, right? There should be deconstruction, but it shouldn't define us in that sense. And it shouldn't define the process in that way. I think one of the things that I like in your book was you said, we're not backsliding, we're growing, right? We're not just deconstructing. We're not going back to a previous state. We're always moving forward. We're always growing in a forward moving direction. And I think when we look at deconstruction in that sense, it's a little more healthy.
Yeah, big time. I think so. And that language of progression or moving forward or spiritual growth, I think is just more honest. And like, because I think ultimately, like, everybody, maybe this is too broad, but I'll be bold. I think everybody experiences some form of deconstruction, because if your faith is static and not growing, then it is dead. And I don't think, like, even if I pick, you know, like a good friend of mine who, you know, I disagree with a lot, they're like hyper Calvinist, whatever, their faith is not the same as when I first met them. It has still grown. I very much disagree with them, like, way a lot, like that's way, right. way a lot, but their faith is still growing. So that means ideas that they once held, they no longer hold. And I think we can view that positively, as, you know, just spiritual growth. And I, too, I want to say that in that, like, I'm comfortable with that meaning, not everybody is, so forgive me, but if that means your spiritual growth or progression means that you no longer find the term Christian helpful in identifying yourself, cool, like, I'm okay with that. I hold, like, a pluralistic understanding of things, but just deconstructing this just seems so negative when we can be talking about it more positively. And as a process relational person, I like the idea of progress and becoming and growing and moving forward rather than just tearing down. I like the positive spin on it.
Yeah. And I'm with you on that. I'm with you 100%. In the chapter, you go into briefly, you know, some of the books and the people, kind of the characters in your life that really started you on that journey, journey in deconstruction, that journey in progressing, and the impact that they had kind of on that for you. Any way you want to expound on kind of who those important characters were and what they had to say that really kind of helped push you along?
Yeah, sure. So I always like telling this story because when I first started out in college, I had this perspective. So I was very arrogant in my faith. I was a good evangelical in the sense that I had everything figured out and I already knew the answers. And no college professor was going to be able to tell me otherwise. And I kind of had this perspective, like, what do I need theology for? I have Jesus. Like, I don't need this stupid theology stuff. And I ended up taking theology classes. I shifted my major. And when I did, one of the first books I read was, I think it was called Evil and the Justice of God by N.T. Wright in my theology class. And I really loved Wright. And my professor encouraged me to read Surprised by Hope, which is Wright's book on, like, heaven, eschatology, this kind of thing. And that book was the thing that actually cracked my foundations, which I like telling that because I'm pretty sure that was not N.T. Wright's goal or desire. It might be to challenge perspectives or, like, say, like, I think I'm right about this. But and specifically what that book did was it broke my concept of, like, heaven and hell, because Wright's thesis in that book is that oftentimes as Christians, we focus on life after death. But what's actually what the Bible is teaching is not life after death, but life after death. Mm. And so Wright has this more instead of this escapist kind of idea that, like, you die because, like, your body's bad, the earth is bad, but luckily your soul goes to heaven, which is good, which is what I was taught growing up, is no, actually, the idea is that heaven and earth were once united completely together, and then they kind of, you know, separated. But the goal of is actually this restoration and redemption of all things, heaven and earth becoming one once again. Mm-hmm. And it's not about our souls escaping to go out there somewhere, but rather, you know, this hope of, like, the same thing that God did for Jesus, he's going to do for all of us, this physical resurrection, restoration of all things. And I was like, whoa, this is so different than anything I've been taught. And that kind of piqued my interest in theology. And then I kind of, you know, started reading him and never looked back.
I like that because it shows that the goal of redemption isn't out there someday, we'll eventually obtain it and then begin to enjoy it, right? But it's here, it's now, right? And when Jesus came, he said, the kingdom, you know, is among you. And our goal is to cultivate that, right? Not to just sit on our hands hating the world and hoping for that someday. So I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that understanding really shifted and changed so many things, because then salvation, as you were saying, became something that wasn't out there that I had to look forward to, but rather an experience that I can have here and now.
Yeah.
And my goal switched from getting to heaven when I die and asking the question, okay, if the kingdom of heaven looks like X, Y, and Z, according to Jesus, how can I make that kingdom a reality here and now? Like, the invitation is to live into the kingdom of God in the present, right? The kingdom of God is among you, rather than, well, this world sucks. At least one day I get to go somewhere else kind of thing. So yes. that was a big shift for me. And then one of the other really big shifts for me was actually, and I mentioned in the chapter, was when I first came in contact with the work of our mutual friend and contributor to the book, Dr. Thomas J. Ord.
Yeah.
I read his book, The Uncontrolling Love of God, An Open and Relational Account of Providence.
Yeah.
And that, I didn't know what open and relational theology was. I didn't even know that was a thing. I just wanted a book about love and God. And I'm pretty sure I typed that into Amazon and that's what I found.
Well, good thing he paid for his advertising that month. So that
yeah,
came
right. To the top. Right. Yeah. That it came to the top. Yeah. And that one was put out by IVP as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't like scary. I was like, oh, if IVP put it out, it must be good. But yeah, Tom's work really kind of started to, to use very Christianese language, plant some seeds for me. And like, Tom kind of existed as like this like voice in the back of my head for a while, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I didn't embrace, like, I didn't read it and then be like, now I am an open and relational theologian. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
I kind of was attracted to open relational theology, but resisted it for a while. And I mean, my early relationship with Tom was like, I'm really interested in this, but also like, maybe you're a heretic. And like, there's interviews fair. Of me like telling Tom that on the podcast. But that work kind of resonated in the background. And then ultimately, you know, much later in, you know, a couple years down the road, is what really helped open me up to the kind of like contemplative, mystical kind of stuff that I'm kind of into now. So anyway, I wanted to give a shout out to Tom because his work has played a huge role in my life.
Yeah, man, I can say the same thing. I would say in my journey, I went from a very short stint of Calvinism and Reformed thinking to being a fairly staunch 5-point Arminian, to exploring the works of Clark Pinnock and John Sanders, and really trying to solve my pressing issue, which was theodicy. You know, why would a good God, a loving God, allow such bad things to happen in our world? And I thought that open theology provided a pretty good answer to that. It talked about God being uncontrolling and emphasizing the free will of God and the future not being decided yet and things like that. And so that's kind of the extent that I went to. And then I ran into Tom's work and I started to read it as well. I had a very fortunate opportunity to meet him online and to start having conversations with him. And yeah, he kind of introduced me to the world of open and relational theology as well. And within that, I got to explore kind of the wide umbrella that is, and really what other open and relational theologians thought, and was introduced more to this process relational point of view that I've really started to gravitate towards. But it's funny, I would say some of your things too, like, you know, God not necessarily being omnipotent in the traditional sense, you know, was heresy maybe about 12 months ago to me, but fully embraced at this point. So I totally get it. So we're along the same lines. And but that's why, you know, that's why I love your podcast. That's why I love, you know, some of these authors and these books. They kind of introduce and challenge your way of thinking and give you an opportunity to kind of reconfigure and rethink options that you really didn't know exist. And so I dig it. I dig it. So, all right. So I've asked you about your deconstruction journey in general, but, you know, theme of the book, I suppose, you know, what specifically made you, and I'm assuming not putting words in your mouth, but you grew up, you know, probably thinking as an good evangelical of eternal conscious torment being truth, or at least that's what you thought. What made you kind of take steps towards saying, you know what, this isn't necessarily something that I can see myself aligning with now?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately for me, one of the big things was theodicy. Like you mentioned, I couldn't reconcile the idea that a God who we say is good and loving, also was a God that would torture people in hell forever.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to kind of really make sense to me. And then also, like, I like to kind of be a contrarian. So part of it was like, oh, cool. Well, like, I'm going to look at this thing that you told me I'm not supposed to. And, sure. You know, and start kind of, you know, questioning and asking, you know, questions around that. But mostly it was the kind of theodicy thing. But then ultimately, too, I think I think our understanding of God really matters, and how we image God is going to impact the rest of our theology and beliefs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from a more intellectual perspective, when I was thinking about it, I was like, okay, well, like, this belief in this, you know, the kind of God I'm thinking about right now that, you know, engages in something like eternal conscious torment, that's not the kind of God that I, you know, one, that I find in the person of Jesus, but two, also that I want to worship.
Yeah.
Because when I worship a God like that, then that means I can act like that God, because we become what we worship. When we, if we believe God is this kind of like in and out, vindictive, like angry, smite you kind of God, then that justifies my behavior and acting accordingly.
Oh, wow.
If I believe God does that, then I can do that too. I can dehumanize people. I can put people in the out group. I can, you know, justify all sorts of things. So that was one of the things, you know, looking back, in the book, one of the things that I mention in, and this is something for me that's more recent rather than, you know, why I necessarily had, you know, started to deconstruct. But I think inherent in this idea of eternal conscious torment is what I call the myth of separation. Mm-hmm. This is very processy language. This is also, I've read a lot of like Buddhist literature as a part of like my deconstruction process. And so you have this idea of like interbeing kind of thing. But anyway, what I mean by the myth of separation is that I think everything is inherently connected. Mm. This is a process way of speaking as well. Another way I can say it is that, like, now that you and I have relationship, Chad, I don't know myself outside of this experience that I've now had with you.
Sure.
I can't fully explain who Josh Patterson is without talking about my relationship with Chad.
I like that.
But everything is like that, right? Yeah. So everything, when I say is connected, I mean deeply, intimately connected.
Yeah.
And I, you know, one of the omnis that I like is omnipresence. I think God really is, I would say, in and through everything.
Yeah.
I'm a panentheist, so not pantheist, although I could be persuaded, but panentheist. Everything is within God, right? The universe is within God and God is within the universe is an easy way to say that. Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea of hell violates this because, you know, everything is interconnected. Everything is can't be separated. And hell completely goes against that because the whole point of it is separation from God, which I think is metaphysically impossible. Does that make sense? And so, and also too, why I think that's the myth of separation, I think, is where sin comes from. When we believe that we're separate from ourselves, from God, from creation, and from each other, sin arises out of those places. So if I believe I'm separate from creation, then I can, you know, destroy the earth. I can, I don't know, maybe utilize it for capital gain, hypothetically, picture, if you will, whatever, you know, cause a major climate crisis. If I believe I'm separate from you, then I can dehumanize you. I can be racist. I can kill you, whatever. If I believe I'm separate from myself, oh my goodness, like all we have to look at is the mental health crisis today. And I think if I believe I'm separate from God, then that
also from a psychological perspective, then you get into like attachment theory. It's not good. And so then I think sin arises out of that. And so,
yeah,
it's a long answer, but all of that to say, I think everything is deeply interconnected, and hell violates my metaphysical understandings of how the world is.
I like that. I like that a lot. You drove into so many things there that I resonate with. But I know that when we talked, when you interviewed me for my chapter, we talked about, you know, truth being found at the convergence of science, theology, and philosophy. And I agree with you 100%, metaphysically speaking. I don't think you can speak of God being in and through all things and then have a doctrine of hell that says that you're separated from God, right? Like the one place God isn't? How's that even possible, right? Heck, I mean, I'm a conditionalist, right? I think that it's possible to spend eternity apart from God, but it's because we cease to exist. I would even agree with you by saying that if we exist, ontologically speaking, we have to be connected with God in some way, right? I love that. I love how you phrase that. And it's our job to increase, obviously God offers us and lures us, but to increase that, and I'll use my buddy Schleiermacher again, and my favorite theologian, but increase that God consciousness, you know, to improve our relationship with him, to realize that he is with us right now, right? He's not the one missing from the equation, right? You know, it's our consciousness of him that is. So I think there's so much good stuff there, man. I think there's so much good stuff, but I also love the fact that you drilled into, if we can agree that God is the greatest metaphysical ideal, and we want to aspire to be as godlike as possible, as we're called to be in scripture, then we can justify torment, torture, dehumanization by believing that that's also a characteristic of God, right? I mean, that's huge, man. That's huge. And I love what you're getting at, drilling into there.
Yeah, I don't know. Just that idea of we become what we worship really, it kind of like stands out to me. That was like kind of like a big aha thing for me. And I want to say, I want to give credit to maybe James K. Smith, where kind of I first, you know, dove into that. And then even too, in a recent conversation, I think I shared this with you off, like kind of off air, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But there was a parenting panel that was happening with some of my buddies that do other podcasts. And Trip Fuller was one of those people. And a question was posed asking like, okay, we've done the whole deconstruction thing. We're at maybe actively in deconstruction. Yeah. But like, how do I raise my kids in a way where it's like the Jesus stuff is great, but like, is going to church good for them, you know, et cetera, this kind of conundrum that so many of us are asking. And Tripp makes this really, really good point where he said, if you think penal substitutionary atonement is bad, mm-hmm. wait until capitalism tells your kid who they are.
Yeah.
Wait until capitalism tells your kid that their only inherent value in this world is what they can contribute. You know, wait until TikTok tells your kid who they are, that if their body, you know, only if they have, you know, a skinny body and, you know, muscles, or if they're female, big boobs or whatever, like we are going to be shaped by something.
Sure.
And so I think if you're a theist, your image of God that you worship, that's how you're going to be shaped. And so if you have a God that is a jerk, you're probably going to be a jerk.
Yeah.
But if you have a God that looks like the person of Jesus, and that's what you aspire to be, then like there's motivation there. I'm not saying it's going to be perfect, right? We mess up all the time. I aspire to be like Jesus, and just ask my wife. I can be a real jerk sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's a better, the framing is better.
Yeah.
And also too, one more thing I want to say about the hell stuff, why I think it's worth thinking about, and I wrote it in the chapter as well, is that I've noticed how anthropocentric, meaning like how people focused our theology is, which makes sense because we are a people and we're writing about the human experience. However, as we learn things from science, like you were saying, to kind of hold science, philosophy, theology together, the universe is growing and expanding.
Yeah.
And God has to be at least as big as the universe. At least that's my opinion. And so to think that one tiny little planet amongst hundreds of billions in the known universe is the only place that has life, and like that somehow if we don't say the right prayer or whatever, get the right, you know, theology check boxes on our test, then we're going to burn in hell forever. That's like, come on, dude. Like, that is very self-centered, very individualistic, very anthropocentric. And I just, it doesn't make sense once you get out of this like Western hyper-individualistic anthropocentric perspective. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to me. So,
yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. Heck, if you've watched the hearings of Congress recently, they're telling us they have the body parts. They have the biologics. We're not the only ones here. So, you know, I mean, no, I agree with you. I mean, it is very hard to conceptualize a vast universe with billions and billions upon billions of suns and stars, that we're the only thing out there that somehow, you know, it's all centered around us, you know? So I'm with you. I'm with you on that. So a selfish question, because I'm a seeker of knowledge in this, and this has post our deconstructing hell conversation, although you alluded to it a little bit in the chapter, as a kind of newbie in process theology and someone resistant to this term, and I think I've told you offline, I'm resistant to this term, but I want to give you a chance to convince me, or at least share with me your experience in it. I just finished Dombrowski's book, Process Mysticism, and I know that you've had him recently on your Rethinking Faith podcast, and so it was a good interview. That's an area that you're exploring that I haven't necessarily been yet open to exploring. So I want to give you a chance to just say, what do you mean by Christian mysticism, mystical practices or contemplative practices, and how's that been beneficial for you?
Yeah. So, when I talk about mysticism, I don't mean like anything super crazy, or like, I'm not talking about like Harry Potter kind of like wizardry, something that. But what I mean by that is simply experiential knowledge of the divine.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think is ubiquitous in human experience. It has been written about across the religious spectrum and by non-religious people. There are like essentially there's two kinds of like mystical experience you're going to get me on a rabbit trail. I have to stay on topic. So that's, I'll start with that. What I mean is experiential knowledge of the divine. That's all I mean by mystical experience. That doesn't mean that you have to have like, oh, and then I was driving to work today and I audibly heard God speak to me.
Yeah.
Not like that. More so for me, it's when I am able to sit down and like do some breathing exercises, relax, and just try to just exist. You can essentially through contemplative practice just get into these kind of states where you feel like an at oneness with everything. Or, you know, I've had like Saint Ignatius, for example, is kind of like was a Jesuit, or is connected with the Jesuit order at least. And he did this thing called imaginative prayer. And imaginative prayer is exactly what it sounds like. I'll give one story, an example, and then I'll let you ask any follow-up questions. But yeah, a mystical experience I had through imaginative prayer was, I was currently working at a brewery as the GM, and I was not very down with the position. I didn't like it. Okay. And so I wanted to pray about it. So I sat down, did my breathing exercises, and just kind of imagined myself at the brewery. And when I would do this, because I had been doing these kind of imaginative prayers for a while, Jesus was always at the end of the bar in my like imaginative prayer, like laughing and having a good time with everybody that was present. And whenever the bartender was like, all right, it's time to clean up for the night, Jesus would say, okay, but one more round. And Jesus would buy one more round for everybody. It's kind of my imaginative experience.
Okay.
And this time I, you know, was praying, you know, doing my thing. And Jesus wasn't where Jesus normally was. Jesus was actually at the door of the brewery, kind of like, it's time to go. And so I was like, oh, okay. But Jesus said, like, again, in this imaginative prayer, there are some people you have to forgive first. And there were three different people that, you know, were actual people from my experience at the brewery. And so in this imaginative prayer, I forgave those three people. And then with Jesus, left the brewery. And then when I was done praying, I knew that I was going to go resign from this brewery position and that everything was going to be okay. And then I did. I just went into work. Was like, hey, I'm not going to do this GM thing anymore. Yeah. So I would say that's an example of a mystical experience. But it's not, I don't know. Yeah. All right. I'll let you ask a follow-up question because there, I can go in so many directions.
No, I like it. So I guess my preconception of mysticism and where I'm wrong in the, you know, in process mysticism, he goes into this, you know, there's two types of thinking about mysticism. One is experience-based, you know, experience of the divine. And the other would be saying, you know, kind of having an apophatic approach to things, you know, that we, it's all negative. We can't have positive knowledge of God, that it's a mystery, right? And we, when we don't understand something, we appeal to this mystery. And it's almost set up as this anti-rationalistic approach to religion and faith. And I think in my head, that's always been my friction with the term mysticism. But what he helps to elucidate, and I think what you're helping to elucidate, is that that's not the mysticism we're talking about here, right? We're talking about the experiential-based mystical interactions with the divine and experience of the divine, right? I think that's something I can get behind, right? I would tailor myself somewhat of a, I wouldn't say mysticist, but I would say pietist in a way. You know, that I think the experience of my faith is extremely important to me. In fact, it's central to me in my communion with the divine, my communion and community with others, with the divine, with God, you know, is central to my faith. So I don't think I'm very far off. So I think you're helping me a lot there in kind of demystifying mysticism, if you will.
Yeah, I'll try to make it even simpler too. Maybe for listeners, what I mean by that, I think a mystic is somebody who, when they look in the face of another person, they see God. Or a mystic is somebody who recognizes that every bush is a burning bush.
I like that.
A mystic, I think, is somebody who has awaken to the reality that God is present in and through all things, and then lives as if that is true. So even in the mundane things, like washing dishes or brushing your teeth or changing a diaper or driving to work, is a mystic is someone who recognizes that God is present in and through all of those things. Brother Lawrence has a book called Practice of the Presence, where he just simply reminded himself every day that the things he was doing for God. It was an act of worship, whether it was, again, washing the dishes or whatever. And I think when I talk about mysticism, that's what I'm talking about. Is this experiential knowledge and relationship with what I would argue is the flow of the universe, the way things really are, which is why I think it ties so nicely into process thinking.
Sure.
And also, I think mysticism makes the most sense within process thinking because if you claim to have direct relationship with the divine, you have to kiss classical theism goodbye, because that God is not relational. Yeah. You can't. Yeah. That God is not impacted by you or your beliefs or your feelings or your thoughts. That God is like unmoved by, you know, the things of the world, whatever. And so these mystics throughout history, throughout tradition, throughout religion, all claim to have experiences with the divine in a way that is truly relational.
Yeah.
And that does not work outside of at least an open relational, but I would say a process relational framework. So
sure. I like that.
Is that clarifying? Does that help?
That is.
I haven't talked about mysticism in a while.
That is super helpful. I think I fancy myself an aspiring mystic. So we'll see. We'll see. I like it though. I like it. So Josh, as we wrap up, how can we continue to connect with you? Where do we find you? How do we tune in, find out what you're learning about and what you have to say?
Yeah. So, there's the podcast. Host the Rethinking Faith podcast, which, people can find anywhere they like to listen to podcasts. So, Apple or Spotify or Podbean or Zencast or whatever it is. I don't know. It'll be around. So there's that. I have an Instagram page, although I'm not very active on it. I'm working on that, but, it's Rethinking Faith on Instagram. And I believe I have my email address on there, which is rethinkingfaithpod@gmail.com. So, I'm fairly responsive. So people can email me, they can DM me, they can just find me personally on Facebook or Instagram. Josh Patterson. Or I think Instagram is jpatty94. There's a nickname in middle school, you know. So
right.
jpatty, right. Yeah, Josh Patterson. Those are some places that people can connect.
Awesome, man. Well, again, sincerely, thank you so much for being part of my book, for being part of this process with me, for hosting the Deconstructing Hell podcast, and, you know, for people who may never pick up the book, just getting our message out to more people and just giving them the freedom to think outside of the box of eternal conscious torment and the impact that that has on our view of God. So truly, thank you. I really appreciate it. Shout out to all the listeners who have been faithfully tuning in as these episodes come out. I just value it, appreciate it, and happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for inviting me and trusting me to, you know, put some thoughts on paper and contribute that and publish it forever now, right? As yeah. It exists objectively within the divine. Forever.
You cannot, like the argument for the reliability of scripture, you know, you can't go out and burn all the copies that are already out there. So change your mind if you will, but you will not change what is written.
That's true. I'm going to go back and read my chapter after we're done talking again, because there's some fun stuff in there.
Oh, there's good and stuff.
I like past Josh. He's a cool person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Good guy. Sure. Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. And thank you. And I don't know. I always say go in peace when I end Rethinking Faith, but so I don't know. Can I do that for this?
I haven't thought.
Do you want to say it?
No. Yes.
You got a tagline?
Maybe in the future I'll come up with my tagline, but go in peace.